have two honorary members of our panel today. Addie Vigren from Gilkey Middle School is my job shadow today. And Senator Beyer also has a job shadow without a nameplate, so I'll let you introduce your job shadow.
I did on the floor, Madam Chair, but you weren't there to hear it, obviously.
Senator Beyer, this is not the time or the place.
Now, someone has special privilege in introducing the shadows on the floor.
I noticed that, too. Actually, I did, too, because Senator Ringo forgot to introduce Ryan.
As I told my job shadow, sometimes being late does
Ryan
have advantage. Okay, anyway, we have a very full agenda today. We're going to take Senate Bill 181 first, and then we're going to take Senate Bill, which one is that one that Bill said? No, the one that Bill wanted.
I don't know.
Yeah, 645, I think. Yeah, we'll take that second, and then we're going to take Senate Bill 275 on third on the agenda. So we will open a hearing on Senate Bill 181. Council?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 181 would provide a means for the court to decline to waive the filing fees or court costs for an inmate who is a plaintiff in an action against a public body. It will allow the court to have an opportunity to review the pleadings, and the court would be given discretion to decline waiver of the costs if the court determined that the pleadings fail to state a claim on which relief can be granted. I've given you the description that does include the proposed Dash 1 amendment that was drafted at the request of Craig Prinz and Judge Leggett.
Thank you. And we have Judge Leggett signed up to testify. Welcome, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. Terry Leggett. I'm a circuit court judge in Marion County, and I appear as a representative of the members, a member of the Governor's Task Force on Criminal Justice Systems, the Subcommittee on Adjudication. This is another small matter that came out of that subcommittee. And just to tell you, currently, if inmates have had three previous lawsuits dismissed, the court cannot waive their filing fees. And the way the filing fee waivers occur is any person that has insufficient funds can apply through a motion to the court for a deferral or waiver of their filing fees. The court's required currently to review that motion and waive their filing fees regardless of the merits of the underlying litigation, except with inmates with that one exception if they had three dismissed. And what you find if you're a judge in a county that has a lot of institutions is that we have lawsuits filed by inmates when they get angry about things, that when they just decide to start filing lawsuits. And they do that, and then the parties that are served are required to respond. In the corrections arena, if it's the corrections person that's filed, the AG's office represents them. Of course, it costs money for the corrections department to pay for those attorneys. Sometimes we have these inmates filing lawsuits against individual people, other public entities, not just corrections division, but most of the time it's the corrections, I should say, department, and its employees or people that work, or sometimes it's volunteers that come out to the corrections division. So there's quite a waste of resources if the lawsuit is frivolous to begin with to allow them to waive. I just pointed out in my testimony, you'll say, well, gee, they just have to come up with the filing fee. In my experience, when they've been denied, when they filed three previous frivolous litigations and they're required to file, I've never had them file again because they don't want to pay money to play this, to file a frivolous lawsuit. They just want to do it if it doesn't cost them anything but, you know, affects other people. So they don't do it. So I'm assuming it'll have the same effect. And I do say that, I think we're picking on inmates. Well, there's already the three strikes and you're out provision. And secondly, I don't disagree that we shouldn't allow anybody to file frivolous lawsuits. You get a fee waiver, but that's a much bigger question and wasn't part of our subcommittee's agenda. There is this amendment. I just request that it be adopted with the amendment. It just gives the judge the discretion. Just means it's not mandatory that you say you it's frivolous, therefore you have to pay a filing fee. It just gives the judge a discretion to waive or not waive. And the way it was written originally just parroted the other language and said the judge didn't have discretion. So, unless there's any questions.
question.
Question, Senator Pazansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how is it for people who are, quote, unquote, outside and they're filing these type of lawsuits? What's the court's option? I just want to make sure we have balance for that we're not going to set up a special class. Maybe the Dash 1 does it because it gives the court discretion. But when I first read the bill and it said may not waive, it seems to me we're putting a stricter liability on a certain class of people based on who they are.
Right. It is true, Chair Burdick and Senator Pranansky, it is true that we already treat inmate litigation differently. Because if you're a private person and you file a lawsuit, even if you filed 100 frivolous lawsuits, we can file another one. And we don't waive your fees. So the decision to change it, to make it different for inmates, happened when we said if you did 3, we could not waive if you filed 3 previous. And that doesn't even, on the current law, even if the inmate's litigation is not frivolous, they have to pay a filing fee if they've had 3 priors. The federal, I wish we could adopt, and I've actually had a discussion with the other judges and want to start this discussion with the bar of having a provision like the federal system has where the judges review people, I mean, I don't want to be too glib, but they call them frequent flyers. People just file lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit, and they're continually dismissed, and people have to respond to them. The federal system will designate some of those people, and the judges review their pleadings before they're filed, and they won't let them file them at all as they continue to do this. We had a person in Marion County that a judge ordered him to stop filing lawsuits, and he was held in contempt because he continued. Some of these people have mental issues, but they are treated differently in that respect. Allowing the judges to have discretion just makes it different. You know, maybe the judge says, I don't know if there's a claim in here, I don't want to review it, so I'm just going to go ahead and waive and let them file and let the AG's office respond.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Other questions from the committee? You know, some years ago, the Wall Street Journal had a big, long story on something called vexatious litigants, and I'm just wondering if that might apply to some of these people who file over and over.
Right. Thank you, Chair Burdick. Yes. There's a couple of things. One of the things in the inmate arena, we don't have much else to do. So, you know, a lot of people use paper to exercise their anger. In the general community, there are just particular people, and like I said, a lot of those people have mental health issues, and most of the ones I've seen have mental health issues where they just file over and over and over again. But we're not, obviously that's not being addressed here.
Okay.
Anything else?
Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for calling me first.
Anybody else want to testify on this? We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 181, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 181. Senator Starr?
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 181.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 181. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? So ordered. Senator Starr?
Yes. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 181 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 181 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I will carry this bill. Senator Pazansky.
I just want to let the chair know that my shadow caught up with me.
Would you like to introduce your shadow, Senator Pazansky?
Laura.
Please?
Yes, Laura Burrows. No relationship to the Burroughses that walk the halls, from what I understand.
And from
and
what?
She is from Gilkey Middle School.
And what grade is she in?
She's 8th grade, and she's proficient in French, and she's taking 3rd-year Spanish. And she's going to be a marine biologist when she picks the school that she's going to go to. I suggested OSU, and I said if you want to go to another land-grant school, Texas A&M would be another great marine biology school.
C'est très bien. Je ne parle pas l'espagnol, mais je parle un peu de français.
Oh,
easy for you to say.
That is good. I'm not speaking Spanish, but I just...
We will now open a public... And welcome to the committee. We will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 645.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 645, it comes to you from Senator Metzger, and it creates a statutory framework for the regulation of structured settlement agreements in Oregon based on the model state structured settlement agreement. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this often comes involved where there is a lawsuit and the parties agree to a settlement, and the settlement of money will be paid over time, and the person who gets the settlement can contract with someone else to receive the money more expeditiously. I think Mr. Cosgrove is here to give you more detail.
Thank you, Mr. President. Paul Cosgrove, the clock is ticking. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the National Association of Settlement Purchasers. And as Mr. Taylor has mentioned, this is a model act. 37 other states have passed this act to deal with this issue. This was negotiated through the NCOIL process. NCOIL is the National Conference of Insurance Legislators, and it has been agreed to by the National Association of Settlement Purchasers, my client, the National Structured Settlement Trade Association, and a variety of other organizations. I have submitted, even before LC finished drafting, this to all the members of the body, represented in the body with lobbyists who I thought might be interested, including the Oregon trial lawyers and the insurance lobby. And there were some expressions of support, some expressions of neutrality, and no expressions of opposition. I would be happy to go through the bill if it's a chair's pleasure, but it is, as Mr. Taylor said, a process for a judicial order to allow the payments to sell all or a portion of those payments to get ready cash.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Thank you. I think this is the first time we've ever had the National Structured Settlement Association appear before a judiciary, and we're very pleased to have you here.
I think, Madam Chair, it's a recognition that there's an association for almost everything.
I appreciate that. Are there any questions, Senator Beyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What was the timeline that this witness said this bill was going to take?
5 minutes, Senator
Beyer. 5 minutes. Can you go through this bill line by line in 5 minutes, Mr. Cosgrove?
It's a very good bill. Thank you, Senator Beyer.
Does it have anything, Madam Chair, to do with body houses or opium smoking houses?
No, that is a separate bill that we will be dealing with over a two-day period in some future time.
Madam Chair, there's just one other thing. There is a Dash 1 amendment. It was only to correct some minor drafting issues to conform the draft to the model, and we would request that you adopt the Dash 1 amendment as well.
I appreciate that. Counsel, did you have anything to add on the Dash 1 amendment?
I did check the Internet, and this is a model act, and it is similar to a law that was passed by Congress.
Thank you. Are there other questions from the committee?
Thank you.
Public hearing on Senate Bill 645 is closed. We open a work session on Senate Bill 645. Senator Starr?
Madam Chair, I move Dash 1 amendments to House to Senate Bill 645.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 645. Is there discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 645 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 645 as amended to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer will carry this bill.
I will.
You will, Senator Beyer. Lucky you. Thank you. Okay, now the moment we've all been waiting for, the public hearing on Senate Bill 275 enacting the Oregon Uniform Trust Code. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 275 does indeed enact the Oregon Uniform Trust Code. This provision essentially adopts numerous uniform or default statutory provisions relating to different forms of trusts, and it also clarifies Oregon law with relationship to definitional terms used in trust law and trust administration. There are several changes made to existing Oregon statutes in order to conform to the Uniform Act, and there are also a few changes to the Uniform Act to conform it to the Oregon law, current Oregon law, and the experts that are here on that can speak to the specifics of it more than I. And the other thing that this bill does is, in generally terms, provides greater flexibility in trust modification. And there are numerous provisions regarding the creation and administration of charitable trusts, pet trusts, spendthrift trusts, and revocable trusts.
Thank you. We have a panel signed up to begin with. Valerie Vollmer from Willamette Law School, Ron Bailey from the Bar Estate Planning Section, Alan Brown from the Bar Elder Law Section, and Tim O'Rourke from the Bar Tax Section, and Susan Gary from the U of O Law School. You can all crowd around, or you can leave somebody in back, however you want to do that. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much.
Identify yourself for the record and go in which order you have decided to go in.
I think we're going this direction.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Valerie Vollmer. I am a law professor at Willamette University College of Law, where I teach in the trust and estates field, and I have been an Oregon lawyer since 1975. I have also served as chair of both the elder law section of the Oregon State Bar and also the estate planning and administration section. I would like, first of all, to talk about why it is that the Uniform Trust Code is important in Oregon and why it's important to enact Senate Bill 275. As many of you may know, trusts have become much more important, certainly during the last 10 to 25 years. And in Oregon, unfortunately, as has been the case in many states, it's very difficult to tell what the trust law is. So particularly if you have a trust document that's silent about a particular legal question, it's hard to know even where to go to figure out what the law is in Oregon. We have very piecemeal statutes. We do have one chapter, ORS Chapter 128, that focuses on trusts, but it is not very comprehensive, certainly as compared to issues such as wills and probate. And it would be very helpful instead to have a comprehensive set of statutes governing trusts and have them all in one place, which is what we are proposing to do. Unless we have a form of trust code, what we have to do in Oregon is consult the American common law, which is not very satisfactory because it means, first of all, we look to see do we have any case law in Oregon, which probably we will not. After that, we go and look at the other states to see if we can find a case from other states that we can look to. And oftentimes, we don't find those either, or they don't seem to be satisfactory. So the only thing that we can do is go to secondary sources, treatises, such as the Restatement of Trusts. And it would be far better if we actually had something in Oregon that we could look to. The other thing I'd like to do is to talk about how the Oregon Uniform Trust Code was adopted, because I think that's very important to understanding why we've done what we've done and how we got to where we are. As is true with many uniform acts, the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws decided that this was an area that cried out for some statutes, because Oregon was not the only state that was very lacking in that area. And so the National Conference, which of course Oregon's commissioners participate in, adopted in 2000 the Uniform Trust Code, which is one of the places that we have begun in looking at the changes that we're proposing in Senate Bill 275. 2.5 years ago, we had a group in Oregon that began looking at the Uniform Trust Code and at Oregon's existing trust statutes to see whether or not it was a good idea in Oregon to enact some form of trust code. And we began with a study committee with 12 members, co-chaired by me and by Professor Susan Gary of the University of Oregon School of Law, who is at the far end of the table here. We tried very hard to make the group extremely comprehensive so that we would have all of the perspectives that would represent the groups that most often deal with trusts and with trust issues. And so we included lawyers from the three sections of the bar that most closely deal with trusts, the estate planning and administration section, the elder law section, and the taxation section. We also included representatives of the Oregon Bankers Association. We included current and former probate judges, and our feeling was that this group would be able to bring comprehensive viewpoints, which indeed they did. And our goal essentially in the committee was to arrive at consensus positions, which is exactly what we were able to do. Before getting to that point, though, we brought in as comprehensive a viewpoint as we could from other people with an interest in trusts. And so we literally solicited input from every other section of the bar. We also solicited input from the Oregon Attorney General's office and had people from the Attorney General's office serve on some of our subcommittees. And that was very helpful to us. As we looked at the Uniform Trust Code, we were actually guided by a couple of very important principles as we decided what we wanted to propose for Oregon's Uniform Trust Code. First of all, we made a decision that if there was existing law in Oregon, our general rule would be to follow existing Oregon law. So that was probably our primary principle. And we were careful to determine what that existing law was. If we felt that there was a change that would improve Oregon law and it was not going to be controversial among interested groups in Oregon, then we would recommend changes to existing Oregon law. But if it appeared there was going to be any controversy, we decided against including any changes from existing law. The second principle, which was a secondary principle that we followed, was where we could to follow the Uniform Trust Code. The primary reason being that all of the states around the country are looking at the Uniform Trust Code right now, and trusts very much cross state lines. So it is extremely helpful if there are a fair number of states that have somewhat similar laws, at least where they don't have a good reason to vary from the National Uniform Trust Code. So we've based generally the Uniform Trust Code in Oregon on the National Uniform Trust Code, but we've changed it wherever we felt appropriate to correspond to existing Oregon law. There will be a number of Oregon witnesses, as you can see, who will testify today from different perspectives of those who provided input into the drafting of Senate Bill 275. I am, in addition to my testimony, also presenting written testimony from two Oregon probate judges. One of them is a former, although she's a current Marion County Circuit Court judge. They are Judge Claudia Burton and Washington County Circuit Court Judge Pro Tem Rita Batts Cobb, both of whom have a good deal of experience in probate matters. Both of them are strong supporters of the Uniform Trust Code and feel that from a judge's perspective it would be very useful. I think I can assure you that we have done absolutely the most thorough job that we could to solicit input and try and adapt the Uniform Trust Code to our needs here in Oregon. By far the most important things that the Oregon Uniform Trust Code would do is to codify for the first time trust law in Oregon and to provide Oregonians with accessible rules for administering trusts. I do want to point out that the Dash 1 amendments have been agreed to by all of the parties involved, including legislative counsel, so I'm assuming that they will be introduced as part of the process. I urge the Judiciary Committee to move this bill to the full Senate with a due pass recommendation. I appreciate the opportunity, as all of us do, to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions, as I'm sure all of the panel would be. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we'll wait till we get through the panel and take questions after that. Thank you. Thank Welcome you. To the committee.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Ron Bailey. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, Oregon. My practice concentrates in the area of trusts and estates. I was chair of the Oregon State Bar Committee on Estate Planning 3 years ago, and at that time I joined this task force to study and help implement the Uniform Trust Code in Oregon. I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Estate Planning and Administration section today in support of the legislation. I would like to just briefly discuss some of the reasons why this code will be beneficial to the residents of Oregon. First of all, it will provide one place where all the law on trust will be put together. It'll be in the statutes. Now, this not only will benefit the trustees, the persons who administer the trust, but the beneficiaries, certainly lawyers, but the general public will have greater access to it also. There will be commentaries to the code itself that we hope to make accessible. We would like to see these in the committee reports. They'll certainly be in law review articles. So in addition to this comprehensive statute, you will have a lot of language to interpret it. Judges, in determining trust matters, will be able to look at case law in other jurisdictions that have adopted the Uniform Commercial Code. And this will be helpful because, as mentioned, we don't have much case law in the area of trusts in this area. A very important aspect is the fact that beneficiaries of trusts will have more benefits. There's two overriding principles with this trust legislation. One is that the trustees must act in good faith and with the intent and purposes set out by the creator of the trust, the settlor. The other thing is the terms of the trust must be for the benefit of beneficiaries. In my practice, several times I've had to ask on behalf of beneficiaries, write to the trustee and say, please give us a copy of the trust. Please give us an accounting of the trust. Please let us know what assets are in the trust. Under Oregon law at the present time, the trustee has no duty to provide this information. Now, he does only if the beneficiary, in writing, requests that the trustee do so. The trust code will turn this around so that the trustee has an affirmative duty to provide information to beneficiaries. This set of rules that we have, this code sets out definitions, sets out creation of trust, trustees' duties, beneficiaries' rights, creditors' claims, and how trusts can be modified and terminated. So persons drafting trusts, when typically it's a lawyer, will have a document, a code to look at to know how they should be drafted. They should specify or stress that a creator of a trust can virtually put in anything that he wants and put provisions that would not be consistent with the Uniform Trust Code, with a few exceptions, and I think that will be mentioned later on down the line here. So it doesn't prevent a person from creating a trust that would be to his wishes. It allows the trustees and the beneficiaries, if they can agree, to modify or to clarify or terminate trusts without applying to a court. So they should save a lot of court action, as long as the settlor's intent is still honored. Recognizes private settlements. And another important aspect is it sets out remedies for breaches of trust. If a trustee does not carry out his duties, it sets out what can happen to him, including money damages. So I really think this will benefit the citizens of Oregon in these ways and many more. And on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Estate Planning Section, we would ask your favorable determination of this and a due pass recommendation to the full Senate.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Chairman Burdick.
Am I on? Chairman Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Alan Brown. I'm an attorney, and I'm here representing the elder law section of the Oregon State Bar. I practiced in Yamhill County since 1970. The elder law section is one of the fastest, well, it is the fastest growing section in the Oregon State Bar. It was founded in 1997, and it currently has 529 members. In the last 20 years, my practice is primarily concentrated in elder law areas. Elder law practice primarily focuses on issues dealing with the elderly.
which can include not only estate planning issues and probate, but also the process of planning for disabilities and planning for long-term care financing and issues of infirmity. Because this is the focus of the elder law practice, elder law is a very trust-intense practice of the law. And the reason being is that the elderly are increasingly looking to trusts within which to do their planning and to address these issues, simply because with a trust you can have seamless management of assets, you can have a transfer of fiduciary interest to somebody that can take care and manage assets if a person becomes infirm. There's also the aspect of it that it keeps it out of court, because if you didn't have a trust, your tools under the current law would be guardianships and conservatorships, which incurs an expense, and it's also a private administration as opposed to public. Oftentimes, even qualifying for Medicaid requires the use of some sort of trust. So elder law practitioners constantly deal with trusts. And as you can imagine, issues come up all the time with trusts on how things are supposed to work, what is intended by the trust, what can happen in this trust. And currently, we find ourselves with an inadequate body of law, as Professor Bollner has indicated. Oregon's a small state. We don't have a lot of case law. The statutory framework that we currently have is brief and, quite frankly, inadequate. And so practitioners such as myself, to answer these questions relating to trust, we have to struggle, as Professor Bollner has indicated, as to what is the law that we need to look to in working with and interpreting some of these trusts. The Uniform Trust Code goes a long way in solving this this problem and having a one codified body of trust law that will add clarity and uniformity to not only the practitioners of the law, such as myself, but to the elderly population that use these tools to plan for disability and infirmity and doing their estate planning. There were two representatives of the Elder Law Executive Committee of the Oregon State Bar that served on this task force. I was one of them. Another attorney, Penny Davis from Portland, served on it for the entire 2.5 years that we have been reviewing this. And the Elder Law section has officially recommended the passage of the Oregon Uniform Trust Code, and it's also my understanding that nationally AARP is behind the actual Uniform Trust Code. So for these reasons, it is important to the in my opinion, the senior community, and it's important to the practice of elder law that the Oregon Uniform Trust Code, as it has been enacted and presented to you, be adopted. And it would be, I urge you on behalf of the elder law section to vote a due pass on this bill. I'm here to answer any questions when the time comes, and thank you very much for this opportunity to address you.
Thank you.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Tim O'Rourke, and I come to you from Portland, Oregon. I came down last night with my young son, Alex, who's 8, and we've been at the Capitol all day observing your work and meeting with Representative Jensen from our area and hopefully Senator Nelson. This has been very educational, watching your morning session and these hearings. I come to you from a different perspective than maybe some of the other folks on the committee. I've been on this trust committee for 2.5 years. As a longtime resident of Portland, Oregon, the problems I see is in the smaller towns. We have a great need for trusts. I deal a lot with trusts for our clients in that they try to keep things private. It's sometimes difficult to keep things private from your neighbors in the smaller town. And so what I deal with a lot for my clients is putting their assets in trust. And the problem we've always had is in Oregon there's very little trust law. And so when we set up trust for our clients, and the idea is for them to keep their assets private from others, and then some issue arises that the trust law doesn't cover, we end up in court, and just the opposite occurs from what they want to happen, which is keep things private. And as Mr. O'Leary pointed out, what this really does is has a number of default provisions. It establishes some good law so that if things aren't thought of, whether people do their own trust or they have an attorney who doesn't do much trust work, do it for them, that there's probably an answer for the question when it arises that isn't really thought about when the trust was put into place. Our law firm in Pendleton is one of the largest in Northeast Oregon, and we do a lot of pro bono work. And so I always get the trust and will questions or cases. And what I see a lot is people are doing their own trust. They'll go to the bookstore and they'll spend $15 and buy a trust kit and they'll fill it out, but it really doesn't address all of the issues. And so there'll be a number of problems because the trust law in Oregon doesn't cover it. And so what we'd have here with this new trust law would have a bunch of default provisions that would cover the issues that arise and hopefully keep people out of court. I'm not a trial attorney. I just do estate planning, trust work, and business law, and I try to stay out of court and hearing rooms like this. And so what I see a lot with these self-made trusts from people that they're just poorly done, and they buy a uniform kind of a trust book and do it themselves, and then as somebody's about ready to die, they'll come in and ask for an opinion, you know, is this okay? And by then it's a little late, and you want to say, well, you know, you try to help them, but by then things have gotten kind of screwed up, and so you end up having to fix the thing anyway. So this law will be very helpful, and I'll be happy to answer any questions when you're ready.
Thank you, and thank you for coming all the way from Pendleton. We just had a hearing last week in Pendleton.
Yes, I know you did.
And it was really just an incredible experience for us. The community really came out for us.
Yeah, and I understand you ate at Rafael's, is that?
Twice. But all of us ate there once, and some of us ate there twice. Actually, Senator Starr missed it, and he regrets it deeply, don't you, Senator Starr?
Well, thank you for coming. I, you know, listening to your Senate session this morning, they kept saying Star C and Star R, was it? Star B. And my son Alex, he was trying to figure out the name of a Star C and a Star B. And then I come here, and I said, that must be our Star C.
That's our Star C. Yes. We're very proud of him. Thank you. And we have our last witness, Susan Gary.
Yes, thank you.
Chair Committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. And Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Susan Gary. I'm on the faculty of the University of Oregon School of Law and have served with Professor Vollmar as the co-chair of the study committee for these many years that we've been working on this project. You've heard now a lot of expressions of support for the bill before you, and I will try to keep my remarks brief so that we'll have plenty of time for questions. You've also heard, I think, have gotten, I hope, a sense of the inclusiveness of our project. The fact that we have tried to involve members from different groups of the bar, from the Attorney General's office, and from pretty much any part of Oregon that Professor Vollmar could track down. She did a great job of pulling together lots of people. My role here is to tell you just briefly about the scope of the trust code, a little bit more than you've heard already, and then to talk a little bit more about our process. The code, as you've heard now a couple times, is default law. For the most part, the person who creates a trust can design the trust as he or she wishes and can make decisions about how the trust will operate, decisions about what the trustees' rights and duties are, what the beneficiaries' duties are. There are, of course, some underlying provisions in the law that require the trustees to act with to act in good faith and in appropriate ways that provide some rights for the beneficiaries that cannot be changed by the settlor. But for the most part, the settlor controls the way the trust is operated, and we have certainly maintained that in this trust code. What the trust code does do is provide a framework of rules that fill in the gaps when the settlor perhaps hasn't provided adequate guidance, and provide some basic rules that will help resolve controversies easily when they arise. There are rules about things like the methods for creating a trust, for modifying the trust, for terminating the trust, rules that deal with when creditors of a settlor or a beneficiary can reach trust assets, rules that provide for the protect the rights of beneficiaries in the trust. We'll talk a little more about that. The rules on the duties and the powers of the trustee, and the times at which someone else can represent a beneficiary, particularly when the beneficiary is a minor or is legally incapacitated. These rules all exist under the common law already. As you have heard today, the trust code puts them in one place where they are more easily accessible, not only to lawyers, but to those who work with trust themselves as beneficiaries or as trustees. The approach of the study committee, as you've heard, has been to codify existing Oregon law and to make changes only where the changes would be non-controversial. We have had the advantage of working with the Uniform Act that has already been adopted in a number of states and has been considered in many more states, so we were able to take advantage of the work that has been done in other states and thinking about some ways in which we might change the Oregon version of the trust code. One of the things that we did modify that we think has improved the code for the people of Oregon has to do with the notification requirements for beneficiaries. The trustee has to report to someone because someone has to be has to have information about the trust in order to keep an eye on the trustee and keep the trustee from doing improper things. But there's a real question about what that duty to report should look like. And you heard from Mr. Bailey earlier about the advantage of having an affirmative duty to report to the beneficiaries so the beneficiaries know what's going on. And we agreed with that approach and incorporated that approach in the trust code. But we were concerned that in some cases there might be reasons that a particular beneficiary should not know about the trust. Sometimes trusts are created for beneficiaries who have behavior issues, drug problems, or other problems that a grandparent or a parent might want the trust available for their benefit but not want the child to know the full extent of the resources available. And we have modified the trust, the Uniform Trust Code, so that the Oregon Trust Code will allow the settlor to decide to whom the notification should be given. The settlor can provide for notification to be given to another person other than the beneficiary if that is the most appropriate way to go. The trustee does have a duty to report to someone, but the settlor gets to decide who that would be. And in certain kinds of trust, a trust that the settlor might create for herself, the settlor can restrict the notification to the settlor and limit it further. So there is still a lot of settlor control about who gets the notice that the trustee has to deliver. Other than that, changes that that we made to Oregon law are quite minimal. We have provided you with three documents that I think will be helpful in understanding the trust code, what it does, and how it changes Oregon law. Those three documents are bound together. One of them, the short document, identifies the changes that the trust code makes to Oregon law. The next longer document is an explanation of the trust code, what it does, and again repeats the changes that it makes, but also provides an explanation overall of what it does. And then the third document is the comments to the Oregon Uniform Trust Act. Those are quite useful in explaining further some of the provisions of the statute, and we ask that those be made part of the written testimony here today. We believe, we on the study committee, believe that the Oregon Uniform Trust Code will serve the people of Oregon well by providing clear answers to some basic questions about the role of the person who creates the trust, the rights of the beneficiaries, and the rights of the trustees. The trust code won't deal with every nuance of trust law, and the courts will still be there to provide an interpretation of the statute when that is necessary. But we think that this clear guidance in the Oregon Trust Act will be a great benefit to the people of Oregon. We would like to ask that the I've got the terminology right. The Dash 1 amendments be included with the bill. I would like to ask that you pass this bill or forward this bill to the full Senate with the due pass recommendation with those amendments, which, as Professor Vollmar said, have been agreed to by the various groups that have worked on this project. I very much appreciate the time that you have spent listening to all of us talk today, and we would be delighted to answer any questions that you have about the trust code.
Thank you. And that concludes the panel and opens it up to questions. I want to just establish for the record that this basically is the framework document, and you made every effort to include existing Oregon law and also made some policy decisions like the affirmative responsibility of the trustee to inform the beneficiary or the other designated person affirmatively.
That's correct, Chair Burdick. And the one of the short version of the three documents that you have identifies the only places in which Oregon law has been changed. For the most part, this document does not change Oregon law, but you are correct in that there are some changes that were made to Oregon law based on the policy decision made by the committee after gathering as much information as possible from various constituent groups that was the right way to go. In any instance where there was disagreement about the policy decision, we chose to conform the Oregon Trust Code to existing Oregon law and not make a change and leave those discussions for another day.
Okay, which leads to my follow-up, and that is that if this legislature decides to change policy in one of these many areas, that there's nothing about this trust code that would limit our ability to make policy changes. Is that correct?
No, not.
Okay. Thank you.
Not at all.
Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My job shadow, Ryan, had a question for Mr. Bailey, I think, is the person who spoke of the consequences that would for the anyone who breached a trust and violates the trust. So I guess he was curious more to if you could expound on that, what the consequences would be for people who violate the trust.
Okay. I'm probably not the best person to answer that. Probably Valerie Bullmer could. But some of the remedies would be to reinterpret the trust, to put in provisions that would be appropriate. There would be damages if a trustee does not perform the trustee's duties. It would include being removed as trustee. There are monetary damages also. Those are a few, but I'd like to defer to Valerie Bullmer on that for a few more. I think she can expand on it.
Ms. Bullmer, did you have any further
questions? Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, excuse me. None of us are litigators. As you heard from our representative from Pendleton, we're all estate planning kinds of people instead. But the Uniform Trust Code does provide guidance to those who do litigate in this area, including a description of the kinds of remedies that are available. And they're quite similar to the remedies that have traditionally been available, although we have not had statutes setting them out. And they do include money damages. They do include, in extreme cases, removal of a trustee who's been behaving improperly. They can include a court ordering a trustee to do something in particular. For example, if a trustee is not interpreting properly the directions about when trust distribution should be made to the beneficiaries, then the court can explain to the trustee what the trust document means, and from then on the trustee is expected to follow the document. And if the trustee fails to do that, then we have the more extreme remedy of potentially removing the trustee and replacing the trustee with someone else.
Good question.
That was a good question, Ryan.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Next we will call, call our next panel now. And I think it's going to be a panel. It's a bunch of bankers we got here. And I don't know if they all want to come up together. I'll let Tim Martinez manage that part of it. We got Tim Martinez, Ken Sherman, and Alan Bennett. Is this kumbaya? Senator Prusansky wants to know if it's kumbaya.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Welcome
for the records. Record Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I have two more lawyers sitting next to me, but I've asked them to be relatively brief. I think you've got a very good background from the bar panel on what we're trying to do in the Uniform Trust Code this year. I would be remiss if I didn't thank the Oregon State Bar for taking the lead on this. As you heard, this has been a 2.5-year process. I think Ken Sherman, Jr., counsel to the OBA, had a lot more hair, and I know Alan Bennett, Senior Vice President at Pioneer Trust Bank here in town, had dark hair when he started this process. So it has been a long, laborious process that I've tried to stay out of as much as possible, and I've succeeded. We are very supportive of Senate Bill 275. We're supportive of the Dash 1 amendments that have been offered today, and we would encourage your support and your moving this bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. With that, I will turn it over to Ken for a brief comments.
I think you have your marching orders.
I certainly do, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ken Sherman, counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. Alan Bennett and I have been working for the last 2.5 years as members of the study group, and it's been a mostly enjoyable experience, one that Tim has been very careful to avoid. We've learned a great deal through that experience and come to appreciate all of the hard work that has gone in and has been done by the National Uniform Committee that put this draft together, and all of the work that it takes to take a uniform draft like that and mold it into a cohesive body of law for adoption here in our state. We think this is badly needed. As so many others have said, the statutory law in Oregon on trust is really quite thin and patchy, and this creates a cohesive body of law that will answer a lot of questions. In my practice, I do some estate planning, and I have always noted that there are a lot of trusts out there that are less than perfectly drafted. There are lots of questions in those drafts and vagueness in the provisions, and I think the provisions of this law will go a long way to helping us to find answers to questions that are left unanswered. As many have said, this is gap filler legislation. It leaves lots of freedom to our clients and to their professional assistants to put together the trust provisions that serve their interests, but it does help us to answer questions that are not answered in a trust instrument. One thing that I've seen in nearly 30 years of representing the OBA is the extent to which banking has become an interstate activity. When I first started, there was no such thing as an interstate bank, and today we have more and more interstate banking activity, and trust administration has very much become an interstate activity. So to have a law that is uniform and that gives us some predictability as to how questions regarding properties held in various states and administered by a trustee here in Oregon is going to be extremely helpful. So for those reasons and for all the others that were spoken to by your earlier panel, we are strongly in support of this legislation. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Alan for his comments.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alan Bennett, and I live in Kaiser. I'm Senior Vice President and Trust Officer of Pioneer Trust Bank here. I've been in the trust business for 36 years, the last 33 of them with Pioneer Trust Bank. And in that capacity, three times in the last 30 years, I've been chair of the Oregon Bankers Association Trust Committee. I'm not currently serving as chair, but as you've heard a number of times, for the last 2.5 years, I've been working on the Uniform Trust Code and representing the trust fiduciary industry and the corporate trustees doing business in Oregon on this committee. I'm not a lawyer. If that's of any value. The present chair of the trust committee, Linda Thomas Bush of U.S. Bank, is in the audience, but I've been authorized to speak in support of the bill for the members of the Trust Committee of the Oregon Bankers Association. The Uniform Trust Code, I'm not going to go into an explanation. You've heard very good explanation, information from those before me. But the way I look at it is it's sort of the third leg of the stool of bringing trust law into the full statutory realm. And why is that important? Because with all the interstate institutions doing business in Oregon, yes, uniformity would help, but what will help both the practitioners and the professional fiduciaries is having a statute to refer to. They will now know that if they are going to advise clients or perform fiduciary services in Oregon, they can turn to the Oregon Revised Statutes and see how the law plays out in our state. As was described before, we had some statutory reference for various specifics of trust law in Oregon, but we had very limited case law to follow up, and so we were dependent on other treatises and national court activity. About in 1997, we adopted the Prudent Investor Act, which was becoming the national model and kind of the accepted standard for trust investment. Last session, we adopted the Uniform Principal and Income Act, which becomes the standard by which you determine how to allocate income and principal during the administration of the trust. And as I say, this is the third leg of the stool, which incorporates the Prudent Investor Act completely, plays well with the Uniform Principal and Income Act, and also brings in such things as the Trustees Powers Act that we already had in our statute, combines it into a one coherent section of the Oregon Revised Statute, and brings us the statutory guidelines for performing trust and fiduciary services in Oregon. I'll give you one brief example of where this, I believe, will help the corporate fiduciaries. The question came up about accounting, and under the current law, you can account to anybody who's remotely attached to the trust if they ask for one, but you're not required to account to them if they don't ask for one. Well, as a trustee, I like to have somebody reviewing what we do and raising issues early rather than, you know, after the happening of some event. So we are usually trying to find somebody to account to, but with privacy laws and the privacy of trust, we can't just decide we're going to account to the kids if they don't ask and if there's no provision in the trust to do so. So on the other hand, sometimes we have the trustor who says, I don't necessarily want my children to know the extent of our estate when I'm gone and their mother's still living on it. And I can understand that as well. So the Uniform Trust Code sets the default rule, but also provides for the person who's writing the trust to modify that rule to meet their specific situation, and that gives the corporate trustee the guidance in walking this tightrope between accounting and not accounting, privacy or non-privacy. So that's an example where this kind of a statute will bring into focus, and anyone can look up the rules. So I'll just close now. As I say, my experience in this business is as a trust administrator as opposed to a estate planning attorney, but in the 2.5 years that I've worked with this, the changes that have been made to conform it to certainly what I believe to be Oregon law, it's been a good process. It's been a broad process. I've incorporated back at the committee meetings the information and ideas I've received from our trust committee on the OBA. I believe this is well crafted, and I urge the committee to adopt the amendment and to move the bill with the amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could just close, I just would, I can tell that this has been just a riveting experience for the committee, and would want you to know that on April 19th in Portland, the annual OBA Trust Dinner will occur, and Professor Vollmer will go into a much more lengthy discussion as our guest speaker. So if there's anybody on the committee would like to come to that dinner, please let me know, and we will make that happen. But with that, we would encourage your passage of Senate Bill 275.
We have a structured settlement event that night. I apologize. Okay, any other questions for the committee?
Thank you.
Okay, our job shadows are now leaving the room, and I want to tell all of you thank you for coming, and I hope you had a great day.
Thank you.
Okay, we have one final witness today speaking on behalf of this Senate Bill 275, and that's Rick Bennett. From AARP. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. For the record, Rick Bennett representing AARP Oregon. As previously indicated, AARP is very supportive of states enacting trust laws that are modeled on the Uniform Trust Code. That's my understanding, and certainly the testimony supports it that the Senate Bill 275 is in fact modeled after the Uniform Trust Code to a significant degree, and with that we offer our support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Short and sweet. Okay, we are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 275, and I'm going to hazard a work session on Senate Bill 275. Open a work session on Senate Bill 275. So, Senator Starr, we have a Dash 1 amendment to Senate
Bill 275. Yes, Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 275.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 275. Is there discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Starr?
Move Senate Bill 275 as amended to the Senate floor with a deep pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 275 as amended to the Senate floor with a deep pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senate Bill 275 is approved and sent to the Senate floor. Is there anybody who would like to carry that? Senator Pazansky wants to carry that. Hurrah, hurrah. And I want to thank all of you who worked on this bill for 2.5 years. That's got to be one of the longer work sessions we've had around here, and it sounds like you really did a worthy job on it. So appreciate all your hard work. And with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 275. And we will open a we will open a public hearing and a public hearing on can we do 599? No, let's switch one we have here. 95 is did we put that over?
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 95 for purposes of moving that to the March 30th meeting. Senate Bill 95 will be considered at the March 30th meeting. Work session closed. What else? And we will open a work session on Senate Bill 115. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This Senate Bill 115 was heard in a public hearing on January 31st. It would repeal the 1987 law that requires the Department of Corrections to provide ongoing medical care to specific individuals who, as inmates, participated in radiation experiments under the direction of Dr. Carl Heller within the Oregon Penitentiary from approximately 1958 to the early 1970s. There was testimony on the 31st concerning the class action lawsuit that was settled in... It was filed in the year 2000. I don't know the exact settlement date, but the class was including 67 surviving inmates. There was a payment of approximately $700,000 as part of the settlement, and also as part of the settlement, it was agreed to by the members of the class that the state would no longer be required to provide ongoing medical care to those inmates who participated in those experiments. This bill essentially repeals the statute that was envisioned pursuant to that class action. We carried it over for a work session because a representative from the Western Prison Rights Project wanted to review the class action settlement agreement. I understand that that has been reviewed. I received a copy of it as well. I reviewed it, and to the extent I understood it, I believe that, that it is consistent with what the Department of Corrections represented to us at the hearing. And since that time, the Department of Corrections has informed me that two inmates remain in state custody who were part of this class. The DOC has advised me that they will continue to provide for their medical care to the extent that those individuals continue to be inmates.
Thank you. Committee, we have, I see no amendments to this.
That's correct.
And we have people from Department of Corrections here in the audience, Cherniak and Ms. And Colette. Colette is here. And so if there's questions, I'm sure we can bring them up, but it looks pretty straightforward. Does anybody have any wish to have that happen?
We have a couple of questions. So I just want to follow up on what we did before to see where we're at.
Okay. Is that for council?
Well, I'm not sure. My understanding, the notes I had, that there were four inmates that were still in the system with issues, and I'm hearing now that maybe two of those four are no longer there.
My understanding from Ms. Peters is that there are two currently.
And then I also had a note down that settlement agreement was violated per Marcus, so Judge Marcus must have made some. I wrote down during the other one, so I'm trying to figure out what that was referring to.
Mr. Cherniak, do you have any? Why don't you come on up and Ms. Peters? Okay. Dangerous to show up in this committee. Do you identify yourself for the record? Thank you.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Stan Zerniak. I'm Assistant Director for Operations of the Oregon Department of Corrections. And I'm not sure I understood the question.
I'm just looking at my notes from when we had the first hearing, which I believe was back on January 31st, or it was, yeah, and since today's the 22nd of March. And what I have down on my notes was three things. What brought this on? That was a question I wrote to just find out exactly what were, and I think we discussed that. I had four inmates that are still in the system with issues. And then the last note I made was settlement agreement violated per Marcus. And I'm assuming Judge Marcus or someone had something that was before them and made a determination at some point the settlement agreement had been violated. And I'm just wanting clarity and making certain that we got the record straight, because what we're getting ready to do is take something off the books that's been there for a reason, and understand that this is a mandatory class action suit, and everyone's supposed to have been taken care of. What we've heard from counsel at this point, there's two remaining individuals that will continue to get care while they're still in custody, and I'm just wanted to see if I can close some loops based on the notes.
Chair Burdick and Senator Pilanski, my understanding is we checked today, there are two inmates. We may have given you wrong information before. Also, it's my understanding that the suit was dismissed in 2001 in a settlement in which the state paid the lump sum that was referenced by Counsel O'Leary. And it did require that inmates release all claims against the state and waiver their rights under state law to further state pay compensation or care.
That satisfy you, Senator?
Well,
I thought I had the settlement agreement in my file. It may be on my desk. If you want to take the next bill, I could go grab it. And
no, that's not. It's not necessary. And the reason that we want to take this off the books is, I assume, it's the customary. It's no longer in effect, or there's no viable reason for leaving it on the books?
Chair Burdick and Senator Pozanski, that is correct. It really has no legal effect since we do have the settlement.
All right. The last question I have, Madam Chair, please. And that is, if for some reason someone that was not counted in the original count of, I think it was 67 surviving inmates, should show up, what is their course of remedy, if any?
Chair Burdick and Senator Pozanski, I'm not really sure what the answer to that is. My understanding is that everyone that would be entitled was in fact included in this class action.
Yeah, to follow that up, did they have an absolute were they able to find everybody? I mean, obviously these people were in custody, which helped find some of them, but were they able to locate everyone who was part of the experiment?
Chair Burdick, I'm just assuming that they did. I'd have to follow up on that and check it out.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'll support it. I guess my reservation is when you have these type of settlements, I mean, to me the settlement takes care of everyone that's in the class. Right. They're under obligation of what they can or can't do. And then if there is, I mean, hopefully there's not someone else, but if they should materialize, we may, as a legislature, be looking at authorizing a lawsuit, if necessary, to give that individual the opportunity to have their case heard if someone was not found. And I would assume, being these type of experiments that were going on in conjunction with the federal government, supposedly everyone was known who was participating in it, mm-hmm. and had done all the cross checks and all that, so it may be for naught, but at the same time, it's one of those things. I guess my pet peeve is it's really unfortunate that our state government got involved in these type of experiments that basically has now resulted in this, and I want to make certain that if someone who was not covered in this class action lawsuit mm-hmm. should materialize, that they have some ability to seek redress.
Well, I presume that, I'm sure, in fact, that we could take care of that if somebody came forward. So appreciate that. Are there other questions from the committee? Okay, we will close the, thank you for
thank you,
us out.
Chair Burdick.
We're in the work session, that's right.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 115 to the Senate floor for due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 115 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Objections? So ordered. Would you like to carry this? Senator Starr, did you want to carry that?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Okay. Now we have, now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 599, which was carried over from yesterday. Council Taylor.
The committee, Senate Bill 599 comes to you from Senator Monis Anderson and requires a court to dismiss a charge of failing to carry proof of insurance if the person charged delivers to the clerk of court proof of insurance showing the driver was insured at the time of the offense. You have the -1 amendments in front of you.
Thank you. We have signed up for this Michelle Rosselow. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michelle Rosslyn from Multnomah County. I also work in the building for Senator Lori Monis Anderson from East Multnomah County. I'm here today because this past August I was pulled over and given a citation for not proving proof of insurance for a borrowed car. Not wanting to pay the high fine for a car that was legally insured, I went through the process, and finally in January, about 5 months later, I went to my court date. In court, I met my officer and showed him my proof of insurance. We then waited for my name to be called, and the officer asked the judge to dismiss the charges against me. Although somewhat exciting, I have to admit, I realized the definite inefficiencies in this process. There were around 15 other police officers in attendance that day. Of those 15, most only had one other offender to testify with, if the offender even showed up at all. Navigating the court system, as I found, can be very confusing, time-consuming, and extremely intimidating. Hence, Senate Bill 599. We always hear about how full and expensive the court system is. The changes I'm proposing will save court costs, police overtime costs, and help citizens from missing work or family duties. There's no need to pay our officers to sit in court for a citation that will likely be dismissed, and the court will receive no monetary benefit. Allowing an individual who is insured at the time of citation to turn in proof of insurance takes a portion of these people out of the process early. Senate Bill 599 requires courts to dismiss the failure to carry proof of insurance charge if the individual delivers proof of compliance to the court. It decreases police officer court time and alleviates undue hardship on individuals that do not live near the city or county where they receive their citation. It does not exempt uninsured drivers, nor does it encourage people to drive without insurance. Important point. They are still held to the same requirements of the law. These tickets are expensive and should not be held against someone who's purchased insurance but cannot find it at the time of citation. There is also a proposed Dash 1 amendment which would delete the court fees line on, well, on the bill, it's line 19, I believe.
Line 17.
Line 17. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate your time in hearing this bill, and I hope you'll vote in favor of it and the Dash 1.
Thank you. Senator Brzezinski, do you have a question?
I do, thank you. Michelle, I'm going to walk you through this because I want to make sure we all understand what we're
asking
to do. Since I do practice in municipal courts, and these are type of tickets that are, I've never seen one of these not dismissed when the person shows up with the ballot documentation. Under this bill, though, what I see is basically if the person comes into court prior to the court date and they hand to the clerk some type of documentation that shows or appears to show that the person or the vehicle was insured at the time of the citation, is it your understanding, your belief that the court then automatically has to dismiss? Or does this, I'm trying to figure out what the procedure is because I don't think, I feel comfortable allowing this decision to be made exclusively by the clerk mm-hmm. as compared to something being filed prior to the hearing date to be referred to the judge and he or she, once they review everything, make that determination.
My impression was that if you brought in your proof of insurance or sent it in, that it would be reviewed by the judge and dismissed through the court process.
But it says the clerk, counsel so has...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Brzezinski, I'm wondering, looking at the amendment, if you'd be more comfortable if it said the court may dismiss rather than the court shall dismiss.
I guess I have no problem with the court being mandated to dismiss it. My only concern is, does the court have the opportunity to review the documents for itself to determine whether or not they agree that the person cited was in fact insured and they just forgot or didn't find it in the car and present it as compared to a staff person for the court making that determination and the judge is signing something. If the way I understand it's intended, and I don't know if we get there, I haven't looked at the Dash ones close enough, it seems to me that that a person who's been cited for failure to furnish proof should be able to bring to the court or mail to the court prior to their scheduled arraignment date the documentation they want, and then that should be reviewed by the court to determine whether or not they agree that they were in compliance with the law. If they were, that I don't see a problem having them dismiss the ticket, and I do agree with what's, I guess, in the Dash 1's taking out the court costs because, to me, there's that would be a new precedent for requiring a court cost for someone to basically prove their innocence, even though technically at the time when they got the citation, they may be in violation. I've never seen a judge not dismiss when they have it, but I just don't want the clerk to have the authority or the duty to make that determination as compared to the judge.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I see Brad Swank from the court administrator's office move up a couple of rows, so I think he may have want to say something on this.
Mr. Swank, would you care to join us? Thank you.
Chair Burdick, Senator Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Oregon Judicial Department. I looked at the Dash 599-1 amendments, and what it says is the court shall dismiss any charge. Hopefully, generally when we read that, we do not read that to mean that court clerks would be doing that. I hope that we have no court clerks dismissing cases. Generally, that's something that's left to a judge, and in this instance, it says the court shall dismiss. We anticipate that with this amendment, that these would be going before either the judge or somebody like a pro tem judge or something like that that's been delegated the authority to do the appropriate review on that. I thought I'd mention 80% of the time somebody who's got this charge has another charge too. So there's...
Yes, that is interesting. And so you're comfortable with the language here that refers to the person delivering it to the clerk, which is good because it tells the person what to do, and you're
yes.
comfortable that the clerk is not going to just be handing out justice.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, one of the things in my day job that I do is that at the end of session we write up things for judges and courts about how they're supposed to follow this, and one of our expectations is that our instructions that we'll probably explain to them either in the training that we do at the end of session or in our summary, that this doesn't mean that somebody who doesn't have the appropriate authority can be dismissing these.
All right. Thank you. I also wanted to ask you whether your car was towed in that circumstance, because I think they have the authority, at least in Portland, to tow a car.
The officer, when he did pull me over, said he had reason to believe that the car was insured. It was borrowed, so I had no idea where it was. So he did not tow my vehicle. I have actually never heard. I don't know if they do that as a practice, but it's a good business for a tow company, I guess.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, committee. Okay, we are. Senator Walker.
I would say I have the same personal experience, not me personally, but my son had the same thing happen, though he did get a speeding ticket, so he was one of the 80% who had another ticket as well. And when the officer asked for proof of insurance, he was driving my car instead of riding his motorcycle, and he did not know where I kept the insurance. So he got both tickets, and when he went to court, they dismissed the second one. But and they lowered the fine on the first one. That was before we sort of mandated that courts couldn't do that anymore. But Ms. Roslow points out makes some very good points about what a waste of judicial time, police officer time, as well as the person who got the ticket, because everybody has to take a day off and troop down to court. And if that is your only ticket, that's an absolute ridiculous waste of time when you know you had the proof of insurance, you just didn't know where it was. Because you borrowed your parents' car or someone else's car to go door knocking or whatever it was you were doing this August, which is probably what you were doing. So I think this is a good bill, and we've had explanation from Mr. Swank that it's not the clerk dismissing it, which was a good point raised by Senator Pozanski. So I'm up for moving this bill with the dash ones.
Well, we're at a point on this committee where everybody has to really love it or nothing will happen. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 599. Senator Starr, we have a dash one amendment.
Yes, move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 599.
Senator Starr has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 599. Is there a discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Senator Starr?
Move Senate Bill 599 is amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation, Madam Chair.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 599 is amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Walker, would you like to carry this, or have you been
sure.
overburdened lately?
No, this one's pretty easy, Madam Chair. I'll do it in honor of my son.
Okay.
Thank you.
I thought you might like to do that. Thank you very much. Now we will take up, my favorite one, the T intersection bill. We will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 493. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 493 was heard for a public hearing on March 14th. The measure would allow a person who is lawfully using a bicycle lane to proceed through a red light at the top of the T intersection. I had attempted to draw a graphic on the staff measure summary, but was unsuccessful. I apologize.
Council, I need to interrupt you. I don't have my act together today. I am actually opening a work session on Senate Bill 493. Proceed. Thank you.
Thanks. And there were two amendments that I was instructed to obtain that are in the form of a dash two amendments. It does two things. The first thing that the dash two does is that it clarifies that the measure only applies to mopeds, among other vehicles, only to the extent that the moped is being exclusively powered by human power. And the dash two also specifies that the road on which the vehicle is operating on would be considered a highway, a private road, driveway, or alley. That does not intersect the bicycle lane. Again, the graphic would be handy, but is missing.
Thank you. Okay. I'm having trouble finding
it. I got the graphic if anyone needs it.
Oh, please, let's see this. I know the graphic because this graphic is based on an intersection within walking distance from my home. In fact, it's 1,320 steps.
That's what they all say.
From my home.
Is that skipping or jumping?
Madam Chair, did you know if you go downstairs in the Galleria today, I think the diabetes folks are down there, and you can pick up some more pedometers.
Oh, yes. I've worn out two so far. Okay. We have in the audience Scott Bricker, if anybody needs to ask any more questions, but we also have the Dash 2 amendments, and we have another situation where everybody has to love this bill or it's not going to be able to move today. So, Senator
Madam
Stark.
Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 493.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 493. Is there a discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 493 is amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 493 is amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Objection? So ordered. Thank you. The bikers are going to have to fight over this one, Senator Pergansky. Would you like to do it?
I won't fight you for it, but I'll do it.
Well, if you're not going to fight me for it, then I'm going to do it. So I will carry this bill. Work session closed on 493. Okay, now we will take up 938, the other continuation of Bicycle Day. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 938.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 938 was heard for a public hearing on March 14th. This bill does three things. It amends the section with respect to passing on the right, it amends the section with respect to the maximum speed at a crosswalk, and it amends the exception concerning a failure to use a bike lane. The Dash 1 amendment has received and should be in your packet, was drafted at the request of the Bicycle Safety Alliance.
Bicycle Transportation Alliance.
I apologize, Mr. Bricker.
BTA.
BTA. And what the amendment does is add an additional exception for failure to use a bike path in the circumstances where the cyclist is preparing to continue straight at an intersection where there is a right turn lane and that bike path goes into the right turn lane. Again, a graphic would be handy, but was exceeding the scope of my technical ability.
And mine as well.
Thank you. Okay, do the committee members have any? There are several things that are done in this bill. Do committee members have any questions on any of them? Okay, let's hazard an attempt here. We're in work session. We have a Dash 1 amendment. Senator?
Pardon? Madam Chair, I move Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 938.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 938. Is there a discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Starr?
Moved Senate Bill 938 to Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 938 to the Senate floor as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
This one's mine.
You want that one, Senator Pazansky? Senator Pazansky got this one. He will carry it. Close the work session on Senate Bill 938. And now we will open the long-awaited work session on it's a work session on Senate Bill 331.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 331 comes to you from the Joint Indian Judiciary Committee, and it was also on for a work session yesterday at the public hearing on February 16th. And you have before you, and I'll emphasize, the Dash 4 amendments. Makes stenographic reporting of a court proceeding is the official record of the proceedings for the purposes of appeal and for use during proceedings if all the parties' proceedings agree to the stenographic reporting. Laura Smith is here and Brad Swank. I believe this is a consensus amendment. I see heads shaking in the audience.
That's a head nod, and they are in the audience. Laura Smith and Brad Swank are in the audience if they have questions. And Senator Senator Pazansky?
We got amendments. Which ones are we working on?
The Dash 4.
Only the Dash 4.
Only the Dash 4. They supersede all other amendments. And make that clear for the record. So,
And Senator Walker, did you have any comments on the bill and the Dash 4 amendments?
The Dash 4, Madam Chair, I had gotten my Dash 3s done, I think, and then there was one other change, and so that's why we have Dash 4s. Mm-hmm. The change that I had wanted when it was brought to me from the little work group was they were allowing reporters who were not properly certified to come in and be in the courtroom, and we don't allow that in court in our state. If you're a state employee court reporter, you have to be certified either at the state level or the national level, and in federal court as well. So I wasn't willing to let that lapse, and so I took that element out that allowed anybody that's established by rule to come in. So I felt being certified was critical to the record. That's what we're caring, what we care about here.
And who does it take, Senator Walker, to become certified?
You have to, at both the state and the national level, you have to pass speed tests and transcription tests and accuracy. It's a pretty big deal. I was one that got grandfathered in when Oregon developed certification standards, so I never had to go through the test, though I took it as a student many times because they tell you to take it as a student. But I was grandfathered in when they switched over the new standards, and I've never let my license lapse. You also, to maintain your license, have to have continuing education credits, just like lawyers do. Quite a few, actually. Sometimes I wonder why so many, but we do it nonetheless, and you know, it keeps you current.
Continuing education, I have absolutely witnessed as you sat on the Senate floor with your little machine recording every unforgettable word we uttered in the last days of the 2003 session.
Yes, Madam Chair, when I sit here for 7 or 8 months, as it has been, not on my machine, I get a little rusty, so I have to bring it out and start recording you guys all on the floor. And I sort of get lost in thought when I do that, but I have excellent notes, and it's really great to be back in the flow of things.
Okay, thank you. Senator
Potasky? I'm just trying to make sure we're PC. Senator Walker kept on referring to being grandfathered in. Isn't it grandmothered in? Or?
You know, I think that's very clever, Senator Potasky. No one's ever questioned that, and I'm so PC, I'm surprised I've never done that.
You know, they used to call him a 90s guy, and then the century turned, so we don't know what to call him now.
Well, at least I don't call the chair Mr. Chair.
Yeah, at least you don't do that, Senator Walker.
Madam Chair, I've reformed, okay.
Oh, I've heard that before. The first 6 times he did it, I thought my ears were tricking me. So, all right. Senator Starr, do you have an opinion on the Dash 4 amendments?
Yes, I'd like to see those incorporated in the bill. So I move the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 331.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 331. Is there discussion?
Madam Chair, only that I need to state the potential conflict of interest on the record, once again, with this bill. While I do not practice as a rule in circuit court, there may be a day that I do that.
I appreciate potential conflict noted. Is there objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 331 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 331 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? So ordered. Senator Walker, would you like to carry this bill?
I would, Madam Chair, and I want to thank the committee for helping keep the record accurate and clean and up to date, because that's what we strive for as court reporters.
So this has been a real learning experience for me and a real believer in having good court reporting. So good luck as you carry this bill. And with that, Senate Judiciary is adjourned. Thank you.
Wow.
Next committee.